Welcome to Island Crimes and Mysteries. And now, it's time to join your host, Nules, for another episode.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story. Guys, before I start today, I would just like to welcome a few new Patreon members. Megan, Aileen, Emer and Janet. Welcome to my Patreon page and thank you for your support. It's really appreciated. And as ever, guys, there is a link to that Patreon page in the description below the podcast. Right, let's get back to today's episode. Some families seem to have it all. The loving marriage, the beautiful home, the successful business and the perfect children. But sometimes, beneath that picture-perfect exterior, darkness lurks. And when it finally rises to the surface, the consequences are devastating. In the small town of Clonroach, County Wexford, Lorraine was a local golden girl. She was beautiful, talented, and came from a family of sporting legends. She had it all. A thriving career, a loving husband, and two beautiful children, and a life that many would envy. Her husband, Dermot Flood, was a successful businessman, a respected figure in the community and a devoted father. Together they were known as the real-life Barbie and Ken, a couple who seemed to be living the dream. But on the night of April 25th, 2008, that dream became a nightmare. A fire tore through the Flood family home in the early hours of the morning, shocking the entire town. Neighbours rushed to help, desperate to find the family inside. But when the flames were extinguished, the horrific truth was revealed. This wasn't an accident. This was something far worse. What drove a man who had everything to commit such an unthinkable act? Why did Dermot Flood, seemingly a loving husband and father, end his entire family's life in one tragic night? And were there warning signs that no one saw? Tonight we uncover the chilling truth behind the Flood family murders, the secrets, the speculation, and the nagging question that lingers to this day. Why? Welcome to Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I'm your host, Nules, and this is the story of the tragedy in Clonroach. Lorraine Keogh was well known for her beauty in the rural parish of Clonroach, County Wexford, where she spent her childhood. With striking blonde hair, piercing blue eyes and defined features, she came from a renowned sporting family. The second youngest of Jim and Kathleen Keogh's children, Lorraine was cherished by her siblings, Seamus, Martina, Rosemary, David, Derek and Peter. Her father's side of the family was deeply embedded in the local hurling and camogie scene, with a reputation that stretched across the town's land surrounding Clonroach. Coming from a family of 17, his talent for the sport was inherited from his own father, a notable player in the 1930s and 40s, who passed down his passion for the games to his children. Lorraine's aunts made history in camogie, achieving success on national level. Greta captained the Wexford team in 1975, while Bridget secured three championship medals between 1968 and 1975. Other family members, including Bernie, Annie and Josephine, also excelled on the pitch, while uncles John, Tommy and Davy made their mark in county hurling. Lorraine grew up immersed in this world of sports, spending weekends on the sidelines cheering for her relatives, surrounded by her cousins and extended family who lived nearby. She attended St. Joseph's National School in Polpeasty before moving on to the Mercy Convent in New Ross for her secondary education. After finishing school, she began working at Culleton Insurance, where her intelligence, dedication and infectious energy quickly made an impression. However, her real love lay in health and fitness, and she dreamed of a career that would allow her to combine working with people and her passion for sports. By her early 20s, Lorraine naturally drew attention wherever she went. She possessed an enviable figure, an unforgettable smile, and eyes that sparkled with warmth. Though she dabbled in modelling, she had no desire to chase a career on the runways of Dublin or London, preferring to stay close to home. She was a gifted performer, actively involved in local pantomimes and musicals throughout her teenage years, and a dedicated member of the choir at St. Clement's Church in Clackbawn, where she attended Mass every Sunday. In 1991, at the age of 22, Lorraine entered the Wexford Strawberry Festival, encouraged by family and friends to do so. Since its establishment in 1967, 3 years before Lorraine was born, the festival had become a staple in the Irish summertime, celebrating the region's famous strawberry crop. Each year, one contestant was selected as the Strawberry Queen, with recent winners moving on to represent Waterford in the prestigious Rose of Tralee Festival. Lorraine dazzled the judges with her beauty and talent, quickly becoming a crowd favourite. Her extended family gathered in large numbers to celebrate as she was paraded down the main street of Enniscorthy, wearing a gleaming crown and a pink sash. Waterford had high hopes for their contender in the prestigious Rose of Tralee that year. Convinced that with Lorraine Keogh representing them, they had a strong chance of taking the title. With her striking beauty and charming personality, she embodied everything the festival sought in a winner. She was confident, warm and effortlessly comfortable in the spotlight. Beyond that, she carried an air of a wholesome country charm, often a winning trait in the competition. The festival, a week-long event culminating in a televised selection process, brought together roses from across the world. Young women of Irish heritage from first, second and third generation families. Each contestant was assigned an escort for the duration of the event. Most of the competitors, aged between 21 and 30, were unmarried and carefully vetted by a selection committee. Those who had boyfriends like Lorraine sometimes requested that their partners accompany them for the occasion. For the past 7 months, Lorraine had been in a relationship with Dermot Flood, a 25-year-old from a well-respected local family. Much like the Keoghs, the Floods were well-regarded in Wexford and had deep roots in hurling. Dermot's father, Shawnee, along with two cousins, had played for the county team in the 1950s. And to this day, family members remained active in the local clubs. Though Dermot and his brothers, Robert, Tom and John, hadn't pursued hurling at a high level, they had followed their father into the family business, a long-standing and successful water drilling company that Shawnee had managed for years. The Floods resided in an elegant period home in the heart of Clonroche, with their business premises situated behind it. Dermot had taken notice of Lorraine when she was still in school, but it wasn't until she turned 21 that he gathered the courage to ask her out. She agreed, and before long they were a couple. The summer of 1991 was an exciting time for them as they set off for Tralee, eager to experience the festival. While Lorraine prepared for the big event, Dermot joined the other escorts, ensuring that the roses were well looked after. As the competition night approached, Lorraine was considered one of the forerunners, with bookmakers even listing her as a favourite to win. When she took to the stage, she charmed both the audience and the host Gay Byrne with her radiant presence. During her brief interview, she spoke about her relationship with Dermot, prompting Gay Byrne to compliment her striking eyes, comparing them to two limpid pools of the Mediterranean. Blushing, she laughed and shared her love for playing guitar, singing in the choir and performing with the Clackbawn Variety Group. When Gay pointed out Dermot in the audience, he playfully asked, "So are you going to marry this fella?" The crowd erupted in laughter. Lorraine grinned and answered, "Well, yes, if he asks me, I will." The response was met with cheers. Gay Byrne teasing, "After 7 months, does he know you're planning to marry him?" Lorraine giggled, casting a glance towards Dermot in the front row. Although the crown ultimately went to the Cork Rose, Lorraine's time in Tralee left a lasting impact. Upon returning to Wexford, she continued her involvement in the Wexford Rose Centre, serving as a judge in subsequent years. 4 years later, in 1995, Lorraine and Dermot tied the knot and settled into his family home on Clonroche's main street, where he worked in the family business. By 1998, Dermot had taken over Sean Flood Pumps Limited, determined to expand it as Ireland's construction boom approached. Lorraine played an active role in running the office, but also pursued her passions for fitness, becoming a qualified yoga and fitness instructor and offering classes in the community. Despite her growing career, Lorraine remained deeply involved in local life, continuing to sing in the church choir and participating in community activities and variety performances. In 2001, the couple welcomed their first child, Mark, followed by the birth of their daughter, Julie, in 2003. As Dermot focused on running his business, Lorraine dedicated her time to caring for their children. But he did remain an attentive father. And when Mark started in Clonroach National School, Dermot personally walked him to school every morning. A year later, when Julie joined her brother, he continued the routine, ensuring both children arrived safely before heading to his office for the day. Their seemingly perfect life made them the envy of many. As I said, they were nicknamed Barbie and Ken. They were admired for their elegance and success. While Dermot was reserved, Lorraine had a vibrant, outgoing nature. They both drove Mercedes. Their ivy-covered period home was one of the most stunning properties in the area, and their children, already showing promise in camogie and hurling, were as charming as their parents. The couple enjoyed frequent holidays abroad and dined out often. Unlike many young families, they never had to worry about a mortgage. And financial records, later examined closely, indicated their prosperity. A shrewd entrepreneur, Dermot had expanded the family business after taking it over in 1998. Originally focused on drilling deep wells, he branched out into supplying water pumps for newly built homes and landscaped gardens. The business flourished. At the same time, Lorraine's fitness classes were thriving. With her toned physique, glowing skin and infectious energy, she was the best advertisement for a healthy lifestyle. Her classes, particularly popular among mothers from the school, regularly attracted up to 30 participants every Tuesday and Thursday at the community centre. In her spare time, she shuttled Mark to hurling training and Julie to Irish dance lessons. The family also held a membership at the local gym and leisure centre, which they attended regularly together. On the morning of Friday, April the 25th, 2008, Dermot followed his usual work routine. His secretary arrived at 9:30 a.m. and he moved between the office and the workshop throughout the morning, appearing in good spirits. Lorraine stopped by just after midday, and later that afternoon, Dermot left to collect the children from school. Fridays were swimming days, and as always, he took Mark and Julie to the pool at the Ferry Carrick Hotel, where they were members. Around 5 p.m, Lorraine was spotted crossing the street to buy something from a local shop. The family left the swimming pool sometime after 6 p.m, sticking to their usual schedule. Shortly after 7:25 p.m, a local man stopped at the Gala garage in Clonroach to pick up a packet of painkillers before heading home in his black Almira. As he drove past the Flood's house, he noticed Dermot, dressed in a green jumper, closing the gates to the property. What unfolded within the walls of their home over the next 10 hours remains a mystery. One that would devastate the whole community. At 5:30 a.m. on Saturday, April the 26th, John Keogh was startled awake by a series of loud bangs. At first they sounded isolated, but then they became more rapid, resembling firecrackers. He peered out his window, horrified to see flames shooting up from the Flood family's two-story home. Without hesitation, he called the Gardaí and Enniscorthy, urgently requesting the fire brigade. Throwing on his clothes, he ran toward the burning house. By the time he arrived, other neighbours had also gathered. Amid the panic, they located an iron bar and forced open a downstairs window. Someone else retrieved a ladder and propped it against the upstairs bedroom window. John quickly scaled the ladder, reaching the top as daylight began to break. Through the glass, he spotted Lorraine lying on her side atop the bed covers, her face turned towards the window. Acting fast, he smashed the window and pulled himself inside, ignoring the suffocating black smoke and encroaching flames. He called her name, shaking her leg in desperation. "Get up! Get up!" he shouted, his voice swallowed by the roar of the fire. But Lorraine didn't stir. A chilling silence filled the room, broken only by the crackling inferno. Then he noticed blood on her chest. Grabbing a blanket, he covered her before stumbling towards the landing, calling out for the children. There was no response, no cries, no sounds at all. The fire was rapidly spreading, consuming the house from right to left, thick smoke making it almost impossible to breathe. Outside, frantic neighbours yelled for him to get out. Unable to endure the heat and fumes any longer, John retreated back to the window and descended the ladder. Helpless, he joined the others in watching the house succumb to the raging flames. The first of the fire engines arrived a few moments later, and firefighters immediately began battling the blaze. Only after the flames were finally subdued could they step inside and confront the devastation that lay before them. Firefighters worked tirelessly to extinguish the flames before they could safely enter the charred remains of the house. Among the first to step inside the smouldering wreckage was Chris Wiles, who carefully made his way upstairs, bracing for what he might find. The devastation was immediate and horrifying. In one of the bedrooms, Lorraine lay motionless on the bed, still covered by the blanket John Keogh had placed over her earlier. In a second bedroom, the lifeless body of a young girl was found clutching a teddy bear. Though the flames had barely touched her, the smoke had blackened her delicate frame. In what seemed to be the hallway, another small body lay amid the debris. Their other child, Mark, was unrecognisable. Meanwhile, firefighter Anthony Nolan moved through what appeared to be the living room, where he made another grim discovery. A body slumped back in an armchair was burned beyond recognition. Its features so badly destroyed that even identifying whether it was a male or female was impossible. The house had been utterly consumed by fire, which investigators suspected had originated downstairs. The loud cracks that had startled John Keogh from his sleep were later confirmed to be the roof tiles exploding from the intense heat. As the first responders secured the scene, Gardaí arrived, setting up cordons to preserve potential forensic evidence. Officers began collecting the names of those who had witnessed anything unusual, knowing that the case ahead would require meticulous investigation. Chief Superintendent John Roach quickly realised that every possible lead would have to be pursued to uncover the truth about the once thriving family, now reduced to charred remains. When word reached him that a shotgun had been found in the wreckage, close to the body in the armchair, he immediately called for reinforcements from the Garda Technical Bureau and the State Pathologist's Office. The presence of the weapon also meant the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation had to be notified. By morning, those who gathered at the still-smoking ruins of the flood's once elegant home were met with reminders of the lives that had been so abruptly ended. A line of children's clothes could be seen swaying in the wind at the back of the house, untouched by all the devastation. Nearby, a child's playhouse stood eerily intact, while the business sign for Sean Flood Pumps remained unscathed on the home's exterior. When a priest arrived to perform the last rites, he was informed that it was too dangerous to enter. Instead, he stood outside saying prayers over the ruins. Even before Deputy State Pathologist Declan Gilsonan conducted examinations on the bodies, it was clear this was no ordinary tragedy. Forensic experts combing through the wreckage quickly concluded that the fire had been deliberately set. The speed and intensity of the blaze suggested an accelerant had been used. The blood John Keogh had seen on Lorraine's body provided another grim revelation. She had suffered a gunshot wound. The massive injury to her chest indicated she had likely been killed before the fire had even begun. As investigators pieced together the scene, all evidence pointed to the unidentified body in the living room being that of Dermot's. A preliminary examination suggested he had been shot in the face at close range. The shotgun found beside the chair was believed to be the murder weapon. Though further testing would be needed, the Gardaí had little doubt that they were dealing with a murder-suicide. If the firearm was confirmed to belong to Dermot, it would nearly eliminate the possibility of outside involvement. With this grim theory in mind, up to 50 Gardaí were assigned to the case. Officers went door to door in the town, still paralysed with shock, speaking to residents who struggled to accept the horrifying possibility that Dermot might have taken the lives of his family before ending his own. Throughout the day, grief-stricken neighbours gathered near the blackened ruins, staring in stunned silence, as though waiting for the burnt remains of the home to reveal the truth. Others sought comfort in action, arriving at the homes of the bereaved with trays of sandwiches, steaming pots of tea and homemade fruit flans. By Sunday morning, any lingering doubts about Dermot's role in the tragedy had been erased. Newspaper headlines screamed of a father who had been driven to commit the unthinkable, a man who seemed to have it all but had thrown it away in an unfathomable act of madness. Reports suggested that he had smothered his children before fatally shooting his wife, leaving behind a devastated community. Rumours circulated about possible financial struggles, and one publication even hinted at a recent visit Dermot had made to a doctor, though the HSE declined to comment. That morning, Father Richard Hayes led a special memorial mass in the local church. The congregation, still reeling from the shock, filled the pews in silence. In his sermon, the priest acknowledged the community's overwhelming grief, but assured them they were not without hope. He pledged the parish's full support to the Flood and Keogh families, describing the tragedy as one that had left everyone feeling numb, helpless and lost. The Bishop of Ferns, Dr. Dennis Brennan, also issued a statement expressing his deep sorrow. "I am mindful of the family and friends of those who have died, the local parish and the diocesan communities, and the many who share in the profound sadness of this terrible event. Across Ireland today, thoughts and prayers are with Clonroach, with the parents and children who have lost their lives, and with the family members, neighbours and friends struggling to process this devastating news." Taoiseach Bertie Ahern added his condolences, acknowledging the profound impact the tragedy had on the nation. "This would shake anyone's heart. In recent years, we've seen too many of these horrific incidents, and all I can do is extend my deepest sympathies to the families, relatives and close friends. For them, it must be utterly earth-shattering." As forensic teams continued their investigation at the flood home on Main Street, Wexford County Council redirected traffic from the area. Despite the barriers, those passing by caught a heartbreaking glimpse of what remained, a once beautiful family home now reduced to ruins. Windows were shattered, the roof was half collapsed, and the front of the house was charred black. With speculation mounting over why a father would commit such an act, the Gardaí called a press conference. Superintendent Kevin Donoghue, head of the Garda press office at the time, issued a concise statement. "All four bodies have injuries consistent with the fire. There is no other injuries of note to Julie or Mark. Lorraine and Dermot sustained injuries that have yet to be fully determined." However, behind the scenes, the conditions of the bodies were so distressing that when Sergeant Brendan Moore travelled to Dublin with Lorraine's brother Seamus and Dermot's brother John to identify the remains, it was deemed too traumatic for them. DNA testing was instead used to confirm the children's identities, while dental records were required for their parents. The remains believed to be Dermot's were in particular gruesome condition. The shotgun blast had obliterated the upper portion of his head, scattering pieces of skull and brain matter throughout the house. Fire had worsened the destruction, further complicating the identification process. That the child's body, initially thought to have been found on the upstairs landing, was beyond recognition. Lorraine's body had been blackened by smoke and damaged by flames, but the fatal gunshot wound to her chest was unmistakable. Journalists descended upon the village, hoping to piece together more details. One Irish Mirror reporter spoke with local resident Jim Redmond, who recounted the terrifying morning. "I woke up at around 5:30 a.m. to the sound of explosions. The roof tiles were shattering. It sounded like fireworks. When I stepped outside, the whole house was ablaze. There was nothing anyone could do. The roof was already caving in. A couple of men from the estate broke down the door and tried to get upstairs, but the heat and smoke forced them back. We just stood there in disbelief. The Floods were the nicest people that you could meet. Dermot was always helping others." Lorraine's uncle, Dennis Kennedy, a local councillor, spoke on behalf of the family. Though they struggled to comprehend what had happened, he emphasised the unity between the Keoghs and the Floods, stating that Dermot's parents would never recover from the shock. "We are a close-knit community, and our only hope is that the support and prayers of those around us help us through." Of course, this devastation extended beyond the immediate family. By Monday morning, parents at Clonroach National School faced the heartbreaking task of explaining to their children why their classmates Mark and Julie would never be returning. That morning, students walked past the burnt-out flood home, still surrounded by Garda barriers. With the road closed, parents parked further down the village and made the final stretch on foot. Many paused outside the ruins, taking a moment of silent reflection before leading their children into the school. Hands were held a little tighter, hugs lingered a little longer, and parents walked away more reluctantly than before. Inside the school, a prayer service was held in honour of the lost children. Principal Norma Doyle addressed the media, offering condolences to both grieving families. "We are heartbroken over the events of the past 2 days. This is an incredibly close-knit community and we are all struggling to come to terms with this tragedy. Our school has lost two wonderful students. Julie was in junior infants and Mark in senior infants. They were bright, happy children, and their absence will be deeply felt." She announced that the school had implemented its critical incidents response plan, with psychologists on hand to provide support for students and staff. Meanwhile, in another public show of unity, the Flood and Keogh families released a joint statement through Dennis Kennedy. "Our two families, who have long shared deep ties, now face the painful journey of rebuilding our lives after this tragedy. A mass was held at Lorraine's parents' home where both families, along with neighbours and friends, came together to support and console one another. We are shattered but united in grief. At this time, we ask for privacy as we mourn and honour our loved ones. We appeal to the media to respect our wish to lay them to rest with dignity, without undue speculation or intrusion. In time, we hope to understand how such a tragedy could unfold. Dermot and Lorraine were beloved children to their parents, cherished siblings and devoted parents to Mark and Julie. Their loss is immeasurable. We extend our heartfelt gratitude to everyone who has offered condolences and support. May Lorraine, Dermot, Mark and Julie rest in peace." The statement also confirmed that the family would be laid to rest together following a funeral mass at St Clement's Church, with burial in Clochbawn Cemetery. This collective response stood in stark contrast to how the country had reacted to previous murder suicides. When Adrian Dunn had killed his wife and children before taking his own life, he was posthumously shunned and buried separately from those he had murdered. I've covered his podcast in one of my Patreon bonus episodes. Despite extensive inquiries, investigators remained convinced that someone somewhere knew something. The evidence gathered by investigators suggested that Dermot had been actively making plans for the future. He had placed orders for business supplies, arranged for his car to be serviced, and even booked a family holiday. However, in contrast to these normal activities, he had also purchased shotgun cartilages and petrol in the weeks leading up to the tragedy. The case dominated newspaper headlines for days, with those who had known the floods struggling to reconcile the horrifying events with the image they had of Dermot, a well-liked, successful businessman who was deeply devoted to his children. Lorraine was remembered as a strikingly beautiful, social and stylish woman who was an adoring mother. As speculation swirled, reports emerged about a phone call Dermot was rumoured to have made at 5 o'clock on the morning of the fire. Meanwhile, questions rose over how Mark had been found. Had he woken up and wandered into the hallway, only to be engulfed by the fire? With the media frenzy and the families desperate for answers, the Gardaí decided to hold a second, more in-depth press conference. Superintendent Kevin Donoghue faced a large crowd of reporters as he outlined the latest findings. He confirmed that investigators were considering the possibility that the children had been drugged before the fire was started, as there was no visible injuries on either of their bodies. Toxicology tests were underway to determine whether sedatives had been administered. He also disclosed that both used and unused shotgun cartilages had been discovered inside the home and that an accelerant may have fueled the fire. He corrected earlier reports about Mark's location, stating that while initial examination suggested he'd been found on the landing, he had actually been in his bedroom. The fire had destroyed the stud partition wall dividing the landing from his room, making it appear as though his body had been discovered outside his bedroom. Unlike Lorraine and Julie, whose bodies were mostly intact, Mark and Dermot had been severely burned. Donoghue reassured the public that the investigation was progressing, saying, "Gardaí have spoken to a significant number of individuals and will continue gathering evidence in the coming days. We are carefully assembling information to piece together what transpired in that house on Saturday morning. Additionally, we are coordinating with any agencies, professionals or individuals who may provide valuable insights." Despite thorough scrutiny of phone records, no relative had received a call from Dermot at the rumoured time. When pressed on whether he had sought medical help before the tragedy, Donoghue was vague. "You might think you're following a logical trail, and then something new completely shifts the picture." His comment reflected the deep frustration of the investigative team, who remained baffled by what had driven Dermot to commit such an act. It later emerged, though not until the inquest, that he had scheduled an appointment for a psychiatric evaluation, set for April the 28th, just 2 days after the fire. In the days before the tragedy, he had visited his local GP several times, complaining of physical symptoms. However, financially, the floods were stable. Their company accounts showed that they earned approximately $100,000 the previous year. And with no mortgage and their cars running through the business, there were no apparent money troubles. Although work had slowed somewhat, there was no clear financial distress. As the funerals approached, the town's grief turned to anger. Many struggled to understand how a man could take the lives of his own wife and two children. Whispers spread that Dermot had been controlling, rarely allowing Lorraine much independence. Some described him as an obsessive husband, consumed by his fear of losing her. "She was everything to him, almost like a possession," one local told a reporter. "He never left her out of his sight. When they were out together, he was completely fixated on her. That devotion turned into something darker." Meanwhile, Gardaí continued questioning a local doctor, piecing together Dermot's mental state in the weeks leading up to the tragedy. On the 1st of May, under a bright spring sky, the remains of the Flood family were brought to St. Clement's Church, where Lorraine had sung in the choir since childhood. Hundreds lined the rural road, waiting solemnly as the enormous funeral procession made its way down the hill. Two hearses, followed by a gathering of at least 500 mourners, including both the Flood and Keogh families, who leaned on each other for support. Dermot's sister carried a framed photograph of Lorraine from the night she was crowned at the Wexford Strawberry Festival. As pallbearers lifted the two small white coffins from the hearses, an eerie silence settled over the crowd, the stillness only broken by the quiet sobs of onlookers. The local community had prepared for this final farewell, setting up overflow parking areas and arranging flowers at the historic 150-year-old church. Inside, two large condolence cards had been placed near the altar, filled with messages from Mark and Julie's classmates. Julie's a colourful collage of butterflies and flowers, Mark's covered with sketches of trains, planes and cars. Father Richard Hayes addressed the mourners, saying, "We are lost, overwhelmed and full of questions. We are angry, searching for someone to blame. This is a tragedy beyond comprehension. We mourn not just the loss of two innocent children, but the entire family, Mark, Julie, Lorraine and Dermot. In this time of darkness, let us remain sensitive and compassionate towards the bereaved families as they navigate their immense pain." At the altar, four coffins stood in a row, two oak, two small and white. Photographs adorned each one. Julie captured in a playful moment, skipping and cuddling the family dog, bundled up in her winter coat. Mark's picture reflected his lively spirit, full of mischief. Lorraine's showing her holding her children in a loving embrace. On Dermot's coffin, a single photograph remained, a wedding portrait of him and Lorraine on their happiest day. The school choir sang A Little Peace, Lorraine's favourite song, the same one she had performed at the Rose of Tralee. The weight of sorrow in the small churchyard was inescapable. Hundreds stood together, bound by grief, left with more questions than answers. It would take a full year before an inquest could bring any clarity. When the toxicology reports were finally revealed, they confirmed that neither Mark nor Julie had been given any sedatives. Though it was impossible to determine their exact cause of death, forensic expert Declan Gillison believed they had likely been smothered. As there was no evidence of smoke inhalation in their lungs, this meant they had died before the fire was set. Traces of an antidepressant were found in Lorraine's system, though the coroner, Dr. Sean Nixon, emphasised that she had been in good health and there was no indication of depression. Dermot, however, had been suffering from serious mental health issues, which he had successfully concealed from his loved ones. A doctor from Clonroche Medical Centre revealed that Dermot had visited multiple times in the days leading up to the tragedy. A week before the incident, he told his GP that he was feeling low due to slow business and lingering winter blues. He complained of waking in the middle of the night, drenched in sweat and experiencing heart palpitations. When the doctor asked about self-harm or suicidal thoughts, Dermot insisted that he would never harm himself. Instead, he voiced fears that he had cancer. Though a full physical examination confirmed he was in good health, Dermot remained convinced something was wrong. Despite reassurances, he continued to return to the clinic, fixated on symptoms of illness. His GP had referred him for psychiatric evaluation, setting an appointment for April the 28th. 2 days too late. At the inquest, Dr. Nixon concluded that Dermot had suffered from a depressive disorder, which had gone unnoticed by those closest to him. What happened that night may never be fully understood. In cases of familicide, there are no winners, only victims. It is a tragedy that will haunt those left behind. Like others before him, Dermot Flood had hidden his growing despair beneath a mask of normalcy. His obsession with his health had warped his perception of the world, and in a moment of unimaginable darkness, he saw only one way out. But why hadn't he left alone? That question would remain forever unanswered. Some stories leave a deep impact, not just because of what happened, but because of the people at the heart of them. Lorraine Keogh, her children Mark and Julie, and Dermot Flood were part of a family that, from the outside, seemed to have everything. A strong marriage, successful careers, a close-knit community. But behind closed doors, something led to one of the most devastating acts imaginable. We may never know what exactly was going through Dermot's mind in the days leading up to that night. What we do know is that this tragedy didn't just affect one family. It shook the entire town. Actually, the entire nation. It left people wondering why and how something like this could happen. This case does remind us of how important it is to check on people around us. Sometimes those people who seem to be doing fine are the ones struggling the most. Conversations around mental health, stress and emotional struggles matter. They're not just for those who ask for help. They're for everyone. So that's it for today's episode, guys. Another tough one. I'll see you in a couple of weeks' time for the next installment. In the meantime, take care.
So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership. And don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto-download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.
You've been listening to Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. Join Newells for another episode coming real soon. And keep up to date by following our social media sites, our YouTube channel, and our website, islandcrimesandmysteries.ie.